welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 203 of the podcast, and it's the end of November 2014 as I record this in a bit of a tizzy, I suppose. I'm off to New Zealand in less than 2 weeks and I have so much to do. Lots and lots to do. So happy times. No, it'd be nice getting some warmth, to be honest. It's quite chilly in the UK at the moment. So it'd be nice to go and lie on the beach. And I'm speaking in Auckland, and I will be working and online, etc. But we'll be enjoying New Zealand. We'll be doing some scuba diving at the Poor Knights Islands. So yeah, very fun. Anyway, today I have an interview with the fantastic David Farland on writing the $1 million outline and using resonance in writing. He has two books out on those things. But David is actually one of those creatives. I think I've called them veterans before, people who've spent, you know, sort of 40 years doing this stuff. David is one of those people who spans many industries. He writes fiction, he writes non-fiction, he writes for games, he does green lighting for movies, and he teaches writing. And he also taught Stephanie Meyer of Twilight fame and James Dashner, whose stuff The Maze Runner is out at the moment in the movie. So I think you'll enjoy the interview, and his books are fantastic. Few things before we get to the interview. I wanted to mention Mark Coker's blog post that has been causing a bit of a stir this week. It's called "Ebook Publishing Gets More Difficult From Here, Here's How to Succeed" on the Smashwords blog, or I've linked to it in the show notes for episode 203. And remember, you can always get the show notes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. And just scroll down the page there and you'll see links to all of the shows, all 203 of them. So Mark says in that quote, "The gravy train of exponential sales growth is over. Indies have hit a brick wall and are scrambling to make sense of it." He talks about a glut of, I don't like the word glut, by the way, but he talks about a glut of high quality books. The rate of growth in ebooks has overtaken demand, and the rate of transition from print to ebooks is slowing. I would say that's only in America. But Mark, and obviously most people make their money from America, myself included, at the moment. So people, lots of people disagreed with Mark, but he has, you know, evidence through Smashwords. Obviously, he has a vested interest because Smashwords makes income from people publishing on Smashwords. And if you go with Kindle Unlimited, for example, you have probably pulled your books off Smashwords. So whatever the feeling, I think this does reflect what some people are going through at the moment. And Mark has some good advice, which I think regardless is good advice. So, for example, take the long view. Good isn't good enough, so you need to make sure you have top quality editing and cover design. And if you listen to this show, of course you use professionals for that type of thing. Also, get better, you know, learn the craft and stand out that way, which I also agree with. Diversify distribution. Again, of course, Mark would say that, but I totally agree. I get, you know, income from Kobo, from Nook, from iBooks as well every month, which I really like. You're running a business, which of course I've said before, and more. So I actually think this article is very positive. The reason being is because hopefully only people who are serious about being writers for the long term will continue in this business. I feel like where we are right now, and you only have to browse you know, Amazon, and there's so many Kindle get rich quick things out there at the moment, and this is not a get rich quick scheme and never has been, in my opinion. Yes, a few people have got rich quick, but hopefully What we're seeing right now is the end of this sort of Kindle Gold Rush period, which will mean the fly-by-nighters will get out of the Kindle space, the ebook space, and move on to the next shiny internet object. Because there are lots and lots of people. I mean, you know, I think everyone has the right to try and make a living, but in a authentic and honest fashion. So there have been a lot of people kind of in this space, trying to, you know, the Amazon guaranteed bestsellers and all that type of thing. But I think as people move on, you know, as people begin to find it more difficult to make money on Kindle, they will move on to the next shiny object in internet marketing and sales and all that. And we can just get back to writing good books, building an audience relatively slowly for most of us, and enjoying being writers. This is not just a business for me. I know I talk about business, but it's so funny. People say this to me sometimes. Oh, you're so commercial. You know, it's just, you're just doing it for the money. And I'm like, hell no. If I was doing it for the money, I wouldn't be writing, you know, kind of supernatural thrillers and the stuff I do. If one was just doing it for the money, you'd be doing it a lot differently to me. And obviously, if I was just doing anything for the money, I would be back at my day job. Earning a hell of a lot more money. But, you know, I do think it's important to run a business. So, but again, enjoy your life. So yeah, I actually think that Mark's post is a good one. I like it. But I would also remind people that the exponential rate of growth in ebooks may well be slowing in the US. I mean, you know, it kind of has to, because, you know, lots of people read ebooks now, but in pretty much every other country in the world, it's barely started. So this is another reason to diversify in your publishing, is to think global. And even in English, I'm not, you know, I think people forget that English is the, like, spoken all over the world, the most global language. So if you publish in English, you can reach people all over the world. So yeah, anyway, moving on. A little update from me. I spent 4 days at the Robert McKee Story Conference last week, and seriously, I feel like it's the best money I've ever spent on my education. I think it's a truly, truly a graduate program for fiction authors. There were also playwrights there, screenwriters, there were actors there, anybody who wants to use story. He also does a story in business course. So even if you write nonfiction, you know, it's how to use story and copywriting and all that type of thing. But anyway, there's absolutely no way I can blog about what I learned, because I have 130 pages of notes in a moleskin. Really amazing. If you have his book, I mean, the book, which is also called Story, is incredible. And the 4 days essentially go through that as a syllabus. But the live event is just totally different, because McKee was an actor originally, and he performs, you know, he really performs. He's very funny, and he's full of insight. Again, older guy, 75 now. So, you know, it was pretty amazing. I found his stamina amazing. As a professional speaker myself, I was like, wow, the guy is phenomenal. I'm pretty much dead after one day. He did 4 days of 9 a.m. till 7 p.m. every day. So if you have a chance to get to Story, or, you know, he does a couple in America every year. He does stuff in Europe. He's coming back to London next November. I will be doing his genre days next year, probably, because I learned so much and pennies were dropping all over the place. Obviously it's expensive. So if you can't afford it, I think the next best thing is the audiobook, the print book, obviously, but I think it's quite dense, so to have it performed for you by Roberts in the audiobook is the next best thing. So if you want to learn more about Story, I recommend that. Those 4 days pretty much finished me off for attempting NaNoWriMo. So I failed miserably and only ended up with 12,000 words on the new novella. But what I have been doing is editing Gates of Hell. So I don't know why I always have to drop my voice and say it in a attempt a sort of growly voice, but it, you know, Gates of Hell. I would like to read my own audiobooks at some point. But anyway, I've just got one last scene, an extra scene I need to write on that, and then it goes to my proofreader. I'm still deciding whether to put it out before the new year or after the new year. This is mainly a entry to the International Thriller Writers Prize. You know, they have awards and things, and I think I want to enter it in a 2015 award, so it needs to be published in 2015. I'm still deciding about that. But it will certainly be on pre-order before Christmas. I've just got the finished cover, which I love. I really love it. It's awesome. I love Derek Murphy, who was on the last show. You know, I think the relationship with your cover designer is very important, as well as the relationship with an editor. But as I've said before, it's a bit like dating. You never find your perfect match on the first try. Other things, Delirium, London Psychic Book 2, is now available as an audiobook, and I have review codes. So please email me if you would like an audiobook review code for Delirium, or actually any of my audiobooks. I'm always happy to give away audio review codes. Email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com. Really important for audiobooks to get reviews, so I'm really keen if anyone would like something. And Delirium opens with a murder in the Imperial War Museum, which used to be the Bedlam Hospital, and the book is resonant with kind of the themes of the history of psychiatry and that, but it's a murder mystery with a deeper edge, and features British detective Jamie Brooke, and female, and Blake Daniel, my psychic, who works at the British Museum and who helps Jamie out. So yes, that's fun. Other things, something I think you might be interested in if you want to learn some more about book marketing for 2015. Jim Kukral from the Sell More Book Show and Author Marketing Club is organising an online conference at authormarketinglive.com, and you can use the promo code PEN, P-E-N-N, to get $50 off. It's all virtual, so you can do it from anywhere. Speakers include Mark Coker from Smashwords, as mentioned, Tim Grohl from First 1000 Copies, who'll be on the show next year, Lewis Howes, who's a super successful entrepreneur and now into book marketing, and I listen to some of his podcasts occasionally. He's a popular guy. Peter Shankman, who started Harrow, Help a Reporter Out, which is really good for PR. Plus, people you may know from this show or the Hair Selmore Book Show, Jim Kukral himself, Derek Murphy, Steve Scott, and Nick Stevenson of Supercharge Your Kindle Sales, who's also coming on the show next year, Shelley Hitz, and many more. So it's a really great lineup, actually, and very affordable. Check it out at authormarketinglive.com and use the promo code PEN, P-E-N-N, to get $50 off. Okay, we are getting the interview, honest. Always so much to say. But this podcast episode is sponsored by 99 Designs, where you can get amazing book cover design, as well as logos, web pages, business cards, t-shirts, which I've been thinking about doing for next year, like some kind of creative with my logo or something. Banner ads, custom illustrations, as I've used the key to the Gates of Hell coming soon. You'll see that on my book cover. And one of the cool features of 99 Designs is the ability to use polls with your audience, so you can get some outside perspective on what people like and comments that may help you decide and avoid the pain of people misinterpreting your cover, which can happen really easily. you put something on the cover and people think it's a self-help book, whereas actually it's, you know, fantasy novel or something. You also only pay if you're happy with one of the designs submitted, so there's no risk. And you can go to 99designs.com/Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A, to get a $99 Power Pack services for free. So that's cool, 99designs.com/Joanna. And finally, this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to the people supporting on Patreon, and a shout out to new sponsors, John Lynch, Russell Phillips, Leslie Watts, and Kathy Pepper. Thank you so much for sponsoring. And Patreon is like a sort of ongoing Kickstarter where you pay per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month. So even if you just give $1 per show, that's $2 maximum a month, less than a coffee. So you can support the show if you like at patreon.com/thecreativepen. So patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much for your support. Now let's get on with the interview. Today I'm here with David Farland. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
It's great to have you on the show. So just as a little introduction, David is an award-winning and New York Times best-selling author of over 50 science fiction and fantasy novels, including the Rune Lords series, as well as screenwriting and working in the games industry. And he also teaches workshops and has several fantastic books for writers. David, so you've had this amazingly varied creative career. I wondered if you could maybe give us a few highlights from your background, just so we know a bit more about you.
Well, sure. I started writing back in the 1980s. I was a pre-medical student in college and decided that my heart was really more into writing. And so I started entering writing contests when I was in school. And I won a number of short story contests and went on to win. I got my first novel contract based upon that. Had a big, I won the International Writers of the Future contest in 1987 and was given a 3-novel contract about a week later. And that kind of went well. My first novel got rave reviews and won a Philip K. Dick Memorial Special Award and kind of set a tone for my career, became a bestseller. And after that, I did all sorts of things. I worked with Star Wars, doing The Courtship of Princess Leia and some fun books for kids. I did a little bit of work with the Mummies series. I went and worked on a video game that was called StarCraft Brood War. So I was a co-leader on the design team for one of the world's largest video games. Went on and became the lead judge for the Writers of the Future contest. And I've also worked in screenwriting, worked as a green lighting analyst in Hollywood for a small production company. And also started teaching at Brigham Young University. I was the science fiction and fantasy writing teacher. And there I taught Brandon Sanderson, who's now a number one New York Times bestselling author, as well as Stephanie Meyer, Brandon Mull, there, and also James Dashner, whose movie The Maze Runner just came out. So number of successful students and this type of thing, and I just keep doing different things. I have a rule, it has to be fun, and I have to be able to make some money at whatever I'm doing. So
that is fantastic. Yeah, so you just have this amazing career, and there's so many things that I can ask you. But what I'm going to do is, because I've read your books, I'm going to ask you your books for writers. I'm going to specifically talk about those. So you have this amazing book called Million Dollar Outlines. And like you mentioned, you've been a green lighting studio guy, and you've taught Stephanie Meyer and James Dashner and all that. So I guess the question here is, and you said about having fun and making money, can authors set out to write a million-dollar bestseller? And if they should, how can they do that?
Well, you know, some people want to do that, and that's a goal. You know, Stephanie Meyer came to me and asked, how do I write the best-selling young adult novel of all time? So I told her, okay. And, you know, and I've had a little bit of help. I was, for example, when I worked for Scholastic, I was asked to help them decide what book to push big for the coming year. And the book that I chose was Harry Potter, which ended up so the number one and number two best-selling books of all time. I've had a little bit of a hand in. But, you know, I think that what it comes down to is I think that you should write what you love. but then figure out how to write it for a wider audience than you otherwise would have. And I think that's kind of the goal that I like to set for people, is say, write what you love, but also recognize that there's a reader behind there. And too many people just don't do that.
Yeah, it seems that way. And so when Stephanie did say that to you, can you break down a bit further, like what you would say to someone coming to you? Well, like me, for example, I write thrillers, but, you know, supernatural mm-hmm. thrillers. Are there things that are in common? And, you know, are they, you know, what makes a million bestseller, basically?
Well, there's a number of things that that do it. And one of them is transport. You've got to take your story and transport your reader into another time and another place. Generally speaking, all top 50 novels and all top 50 movies of all time have done that. In fact, there isn't an exception in transport. The next thing that I look for is write for a wide audience, and that means male and female and old and young. If you can write to a wide audience, then that's going to increase your chances of being a bestseller. And that was one of the first things that I saw with Rowling, was that in Harry Potter, and also that we had a wonderful sense of transport, but also this is a story that was written for everyone. And then the third thing that I look for, and I'm just going to name three, is I look for something that has what I call that scores high on the emotional Richter scale. So that when you look at your books that you've read, you want to say, of all the horror novels, this is the greatest supernatural thriller I've ever read. Okay. And you want people to say that, because then your story is what I call remarkable. And that means that people just talk about it. Okay. They say, oh, that's really cool. That was such a great book. You got to. And so when they're talking at Halloween, for example, about what are the greatest movies or the greatest books of all time in the horror genre, your name comes up year after year after year. And if you can work towards doing that, the whole thing of emotional transport is kind of a science that would take me hours to just go through and talk about that here. So that's why I have to put it in the book and of course in my classes and that type of thing.
Yeah, I find that when you think about it, it's obvious. And you list things. Obviously, Titanic was a different place and a different mm-hmm. time. And then, you know, a lot of these movies, Avatar, you mentioned, I think, you know, mm-hmm. also Cameron, you know, is a different planet and things, which is amazing. And my question there would be, do you have to... You know, what's your feeling around time spent in creating a world? So do you have to have a long book? A lot of these are longer books or series. Is length important in this transport aspect?
It really is. If you look at the best-selling books of all time in each genre, okay, Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, of course, when it came out, was four times longer than any fantasy novel that had ever been written. Dune, when it came out, my mentor, Algis Budrus, talked about that in his review, specifically said, this is a good book, but what shocked me was just how long this was. You know, it was rejected by 40 publishers before it got picked up. Other ones that are similar, Tale of Two Cities was a huge novel. When the best-selling book of all time in the romance genre came out, Gone with the Wind, it was a good four times longer than anything that was being published at that time. And so that element of transport usually takes a lot of time to get us into another time and another place. Now, you can transport us to your time and place. You know, if you write about London or something like that, I would absolutely love it, because I love going to London and it would give me that sense of transport. So you don't have to do that all the time. It's just a thing that you can do.
Which is really interesting, that kind of longer book idea, which, you know, I appreciate is in terms of a sense of value for the customer. What do you think about the current trend for novellas and shorter books with digital? How does that fit in?
Well, if you write shorter books in a digital series, then it can work just fine, because what you're really doing is you're writing a long novel that's broken up into shorter pieces. And so people who are writing, for example, a big fat fantasies and putting them in, it actually gives you the opportunity to write what we call a mega novel. And a mega novel is a book that's so big that it couldn't be published anywhere. And examples of a mega novel, for example, Robert Jordan's books, you know, Brandon, when he was doing them, they said these have to be 400,000 words long, which is four times as long as any other fantasy novel. Those are just huge. And you could, in theory, write a book that was, you know, 2 million words long or something like that, and then break it down into little novellas and sell us, you know, five chapters at a time or something. So it does work. It also works really good for romance, where generally speaking, you're just trying hard to arouse a powerful emotion, and you can do that in a fairly short amount of time. And so those can work really well as novellas. So it's a philosophy that can work. A lot of people are using it as their strategy right now, serializing novels and this kind of thing. I have to admit, I'm the kind of person who still likes a fat book. You know, I love to sit down with a book and say, okay, I'm going to get deep inside this and be taken to another time and another place and just really enjoy it.
Yeah, I just read Stephen King's It, you know, and I almost didn't realize how long it was because I bought it digitally, and it just, you know, it's a very long book, actually. I think it is. The uncut, you know, version, and oh my goodness. But I agree with you, you know, there was that real sense. And then that emotional side, you know, when we talk about emotion and romance, it's kind of obvious. But what are the other, you know, love, obviously, what are some of the other big emotions that these best-selling books, these million-dollar sellers, tap into?
Well, there's a number of them. And if you think about, you know, we talk about genres and we use the word genres in describing books. And the truth is we're almost always describing emotions. So, for example, there's mystery or intrigue. There's thrillers or adventure, roughly the same kind of emotion that we're tapping into. You can tap into drama or comedy. Science fiction and fantasy, early on back in the 1950s, there was an editor who wanted to have them called the wonder literatures because that's the sense of wonder that's being aroused there. So those are the major ones. So, you know, wonder, romance, humor, horror, adventure. Drama, of course, and there are some other emotions that we don't talk about. For example, nostalgia is a pretty powerful emotion. And when I was in Hollywood, we didn't study stories with the idea of how powerful is the draw for nostalgia. And yet we probably could have, we should have, because that gets closer to that resonance that we were talking about earlier, you know. How do people feel about this? Have they feel like they've been here before? Is it comfortable? So a lot of people who start reading, for example, like Lord of the Rings, and they love the elves and the dwarves, want to read more books about elves and dwarves. And all around the world, there's this market of people who are reading more for nostalgia because they want to read another elf and dwarf book than they are really reading for a sense of wonder and seeing something brand new again.
No, that's a good point. And in fact, my husband, who loves fantasy, I think he's read The Lord of the Rings like 25 times or something, presumably because the nostalgia of even reading it is is the point. But yeah, no, that's interesting. But just on the other thing, you mentioned resonance there, and you've got another book, which is Drawing on the Power of Resonance in Writing. So maybe you could explain what resonance is and why that's important.
Well, resonance, how should I explain this? Resonance is that feeling that you get when you've seen something before and you've loved it, and it arouses an expectation that you're going to like this too. And so a lot of times when we write a book, we're kind of having a conversation with other writers. Everybody has read these kinds of stories before, and so you can look at a story that has powerful resonance, that draws upon that which came before and really see where it came from and why it works. So for example, in music, the word resonance is used to describe if you've got musical notes that are being hit that have been hit before. So you can go bum, 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 bum. Okay, it's the same notes being hit over, bum, bum, bum. And then, of course, we do a variation on it. And in music, that's the way that you do it. You've got your little riff, and then your variation. And you go through three times, and then you do it over and change it up. Well, that's a pattern that's been used in music for years. And we do it in books, too. So that when you pick up a romance novel, you're also kind of judging it based upon all the romance novels you've seen before. And so we can have stories like Lord of the Rings, which drew heavily on resonance from a number of places. It drew on Walt Disney's movies to a certain degree, but it also drew upon, you know, ancient folklore, and it drew upon movies. It drew upon the pre-Raphaelite writers. It drew upon people like William Butler Yeats for the literary allusions. So there's a lot of things that went into this, both in the imagery and in the words that really made it popular. And we don't often think about these kinds of things. It's subconscious. But if you look at a movie from Disney, for example, you look at something like the Lego Movie. You know, how many callbacks were there in the Lego Movie to other movies that have been done in the past? I mean, it had Star Wars, it had Batman, it had Superman, it had, just literally probably 50 or 100 different movies that had callbacks in the Lego Movie. It became the best-selling Disney movie of all time. Mm-hmm. The one before that, that came out, Frozen, had about 60 or 70, where you could listen to the music and you could see, oh, that's similar to the music from this, and you could see an image, you go, oh, there's the Sound of Music, there's the Terminator, there's, you know, and it'll have 60 or 70 different callbacks to it. And so very often when we're writing, we're not conscious of what we're drawing from. And the goal in the book on resonance is really to teach you to draw consciously upon things that have come before so that you really know what you're resonating with and why you're doing it. Every once in a while, you'll find a writer who wants to write a novel that has no resonance with anything popular. They're like, I read this obscure little book when I was 8 years old that I really loved. And, you know, it might resonate with that quite well, but the truth is nobody else read it, you know. And you can look at some hits. For example, when the movie The Pirates of the Caribbean came out, it was named after the rides at Disneyland, okay, so that it would resonate with anybody who'd ever been to the Disneyland ride. And that was part of the reason they made it, was to revamp the Disneyland rides of the Caribbean. The reason that was popular, though, at the rides of the Caribbean, was because of the Errol Flynn movies. Errol Flynn movies came out because back in the 1880s, we had Treasure Island that became hugely popular, and everybody wanted to write movies about pirates or books about pirates, and so people started making movies to capture that audience. And of course, that was popular because Swiss Family Robinson back in the 1820s and 30s was a huge hit, and that was popular because Robinson Crusoe was a huge hit. Each one of those drew upon the resonance of the previous one, so that the entire thing keeps exploding over the generations. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. You know, you can look at how Tolkien resonates, and you can figure out how to write Tolkien, how to change it up, improve it, do it better, and create something that has powerful resonance with that, but also is something new.
Yeah, and it makes sense when you're saying it, and, you know, I've read the book and it makes sense as well. But I imagine there are people listening who are saying, but, you know, what about being original? How does being original fit into all this resonance stuff?
you have to be original, because you take it to the next level, you know. When Stephanie Meyer, for example, wanted to write Twilight, you know, she said, how do I write the best-selling young adult novel of all time? And I said, oh, that's easy. You take a 16-year-old girl and you have her meet somebody who's strange, who has unusual powers, and you basically create something that has a strong sense of romance to it, but also a strong sense of wonder. And so, and I said, there's complex reasons why this works. But in any case, she said, okay. But she did little things to the vampires to make them different. You know, hers glittered in the sunlight, okay? Things like that. And there's a lot of people who said, oh, I hate glittery vampires. But there's a lot of people who loved it, who said this really aroused a sense of wonder in me. And the idea of falling in love with a vampire who's, you know, been around for 180 years and, you know, all these kinds of things. She had to go back and sort of recreate the genre is what you're trying to do.
Which is a tall order.
It is. It requires you, you know, first of all, you've got to be a good storyteller. And so you have to understand how the bones of a story work, how you're going to put that together. And then you have to understand how the resonance works, and you have to go in, and then you have to write it well on a line-by-line basis. And so you've got a bunch of different skills. Literally, I had put out a little thing on how to win writing contests today, and I was like, gosh, I've given them 85 different things you've got to do right just to win a writing contest. And that's how I started winning writing contests when I was young. I just made a list of how you could judge stories and thought about each of those items as I began writing. And of course, the list has grown over the years. But the point here is there's still an awful lot that you have to do. It's not something that you can just blunder into. Okay, I think that to become a skilled storyteller and a skilled writer is it's equivalent of going out and earning a doctor's degree. And the reason for that is because the average writer takes about 7 years from the time they sign to the time that they get publishable, and another 7 years from the time that they start publishing to the time they become bestsellers. So you're talking a 14 years apprenticeship in order to just gain the skills that you need to be a best-selling writer. And if you want to be a monumental writer, somebody whose books are remembered as the best that there have ever been, then you've got to develop even more skills than that. You've got to take it to a level higher.
Yeah, and I love hearing this, and it makes me feel better because, you know, I feel like, well, you know, I've been writing 4 years. I'm only halfway through a basic apprenticeship. So, you know, and I love learning this stuff. So I really appreciate what you teach. But I know that some people feel about, you know, like the pantsing and plotting thing. What you're talking about is very much breaking things down and almost reconstructing things. What do you think about the people who kind of do the pantsing approach, like someone like Lee Child, who says he only writes one draft and it's kind of perfect?
Well, you know, there are people who are such skilled storytellers that they can do that, you know. For most of us, it's hard work that we go and we have to sort of practice, which is what the early drafts are. And there are some people who can do that. And there are people who have written immortal stories that they wrote on by the seat of their pants. People like Stephen King is a pantser. Okay. Those are really rare. I would say that's maybe only 1 in 20 people can do that. Most people just find out that they start writing and they get themselves into blind alleys where their characters are getting their throats slit, and they're like, wait a minute, I just wrote, how do I go back and fix this? And so there are a lot of people who do that and who try it. And it's partly because there has for a long time been this myth of the creative genius who they have a dream, for example, and then go write it down. And there are people who genuinely do that, but they're extremely rare. You know, Stephanie Meyer, I believe she had a dream about what to write, but we talked about it a year and a half before she wrote it. And then she said, I've never thought about writing a book like that. I'll have to think about that. And I think her subconscious thought about it and basically generated the storyline. And then whenever I'm ready to write, I have a dream. You know, it's sort of like my subconscious starts speaking to us that way, because the subconscious can't speak to you in words. Okay. It's not hooked up to the word center in your brain. It sends you images. It'll send you emotions. It'll send you, you know, little wisps of thoughts, and all of a sudden you have to concoct your story out of those.
And how do you capture those thoughts and images? Do you have what's your process as a writer?
Well, I think that the easy thing for me to do is to keep a computer right next to my bed. and what I like to do is I actually train myself. I'll think about my plot before I go to sleep so that I'll dream about it. And when I wake up in the morning, I generally can sit down and write a scene first thing in the morning without even thinking about what I'm going to write. I may have pondered it and wondered how I should handle it the night before. But what happens is that I train my subconscious mind, my right brain, you might say, to say, okay, this is important to me. I need to resolve this. And then when I wake up in the morning, so I learned how to write in my sleep, basically, is the way to do it. And having a notebook handy, keeping that with you is just really, it's really priceless. I think that most writers will have a notebook, you know, anywhere within their grasp. I always keep one in my car, suitcase, one by the side of the bed. So if I have a great idea, I can go write it down.
No, absolutely. And I love the fact that you mentioned fun at the beginning. And I learn a lot from Dean Wesley Smith as well, who, you know, mm-hmm. you know, and he talks about having fun as well. But it's something, I guess maybe because I'm still in my apprenticeship period, but there's what, you know, it's hard work as well. And mm-hmm. the fun aspect I'm starting to get slowly, you know, how does the fun aspect balance with the hard work? And, you know, what is hard at your level of writing?
For me, at my level of writing, hard is when somebody wants me to do a job that I just, you know, I just don't like, I don't believe in, you know. For example, I was recently asked to write a video game, and I started looking at the content of the video game, and I just thought, oh, God, this is terrible. I don't want to do this. And so it's really anything that just doesn't interest me. If I get excited by the idea, if it's got some fascinating characters or an interesting world, but, you know, anytime that I get asked to work on a video game that is just like every other video game, you know, I just say, no, I'm not really interested in that.
Yeah, no, well, that's great. And you're at the point where you can turn down stuff that isn't interesting, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's really great that I can do that, because I know that there are people who feel like I can't turn it down, you know, and I would just say, you know, if you don't turn it down, then what happens is you end up getting stuck writing the kind of thing that you don't want to write forever, okay? Mm-hmm. When I wrote my first novel, I wrote a kind of a cyberpunk / Latin American fantasy realism crossover. And my editor said, what do you want to write next? And I said, I want to do a big, fat Tolkien-esque fantasy. And she said, but Dave, you've gotten farther with one book than most people have in 20 years. You know, you're on the bestseller lists and et cetera, et cetera. And she said, we don't want a big fantasy from you. We want more of this. So I wrote science fiction for about 10 years. Mm. And every time that I'd start a novel, I would feel like I still want to write that big fantasy. So I wrote one for my birthday and gave it to myself as a birthday present. Sent it into my publisher, and now they don't want any science fiction from me. I'm a best-selling fantasy author. So, you know, I think you have to pick your rut that you want to get stuck in, you know. And, of course, I kind of live without ruts, because one of the things that I do is I switch a lot. And I recently wrote an award-winning historical novel. And I also, my last book, Nightingale, was a young adult fantasy, kind of science fiction-y thriller, won half a dozen awards. And so, you know, I like to do all sorts of things. That's kind of my problem as a writer, because, you know, people are like, what do you want to do next? I think I'll go write a screenplay. You know, that's just wanky. Nobody should do that. You know, I'd say don't take my career path is what I guess I'm saying, because everybody needs to have their own career path and do what they enjoy. And there are people who say, I want to write romance novels day in, day out for the next 30 years. And if you do, great. You'll probably have a wonderful career in that.
But yeah, but it sounds boring to me as well. It just
yeah, exactly. Exactly. I like to do different things. And I don't know what I'm going to write next. I can sit down and write a comedy or something like that and have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, and that's great. That's kind of being true to your creative soul or whatever you want to call it. But I'm interested, what about an author brand? Do you think an author brand or an author name is important? Because you have used several different names, haven't you? But was that because of your publisher? And do you think things are different in this new environment?
No, it's I did it because the name Wolverton, my real name, put me on the very bottom shelf at the bookstores. And I had read a survey that said Campbell Soup did a survey and found that 92% of all people will not bend over to pick up their favorite can of soup off the bottom shelf at the supermarket. And I thought, wow, what am I doing to myself? 92% of my fans don't want to lean over to pick up my books. And so David Farland fits much more nicely on the bookshelves than Dave Wolverton ever did. So I switched my name for that reason. But then also there's that whole branding thing. You know, when you start writing, I think it is good to stick with one name. And so if I were to do it over, I would stick with David Farland. But there's a big important thing that happens. When you put out a book in a genre like science fiction, what happens is one of the big problems that we have is that the book buyers have electronic mediums that go through and follow how those sell. So BookScan will give a report on how well it does. Well, if you write a book in another medium, let's say I write a big thriller, if I sell 100,000 copies in science fiction, I'm doing great. But in thriller genre, my publisher would drop me in a minute for only having 100,000 sales. And so you can actually destroy your career by having only one name if you're in the mainstream literary field. Now, if you're self-publishing, it doesn't matter. Okay. And so I think we're going to see an era where, where authors can use their names, but primarily it's going to have to happen for online sales. And books aren't stacked the same way. You know, if I write a book under Wolverton now, and somebody's going online to buy it, then they don't have to bend over and pick it up off the bottom shelf. It's right there on the computer with all the other ones.
Yeah.
And so that's a good thing too. So a lot of the rules are changing nowadays.
And what do you think about that? What do you think of the sort of self-publishing revolution or digital revolution?
Well, you know, I make a lot of money self-publishing. I went and put out my book Million Dollar Outlines, and I thought, well, maybe I'll sell a few copies. And next thing I knew, it stayed on the top of the bestseller list in writing books for the next 9 months. And I didn't go out and sell it or put up ads or anything. I mean, it just sort of took off. And every once in a while, something like that hits. And you know, I've got enough of a fan base that I can do that. But so I think it's great. I think it empowers authors. I also think that a lot of authors are just a little bit delusional as far as where their talents are. You know, they're young, they're new, they're eager, they're excited, and they don't know how far away they are from being publishable. And so they'll go out and usually try it a little bit too early. And so I would recommend, hey, it's a great medium, it's a great way to go, but you really need to go out, put manuscripts in front of real readers, and get critical feedback from somebody besides your wife or your mother, you know?
Yeah.
Because I've seen that too many times.
Yeah, and you, of course, you judge competitions, and so you know what good writing is. So I think it's definitely a good point. But we're almost coming to the end now, but I did want to ask you about longevity. I mean, you mentioned that people are starting too early. You've had a long writing career. What are the kind of the top things that authors need in order to have a long-term writing career?
I think there's a lot of things. I think the first thing that you have to do, I think that loving the craft is really important. You know, just loving the fact of sitting down and putting words onto a piece of paper and doing it beautifully is important to longevity. If I didn't love this, I would go do something else. You know, I've worked as a business manager in a number of fields. In the last 5 years, I've been asked to be the head of a movie company, a video game company. I mean, I could do anything I want, and this is what I want to do. So loving what you do is important. And the great thing about this is that no matter how good you are, you can always get better. And so there's a sense that you've got a career path in front of you. There's always something new or different or something that you can do better that you haven't done before. So I think that's important. The other thing is just, you know, understanding the markets, being aware of what it is people want is so important, and new writers are very often just blind to that. And I think that one of the things that I've had going for me is I can read the future, I guess, is about the easiest way to say it. I can look at a book and say, oh, this is going to have a long life, and this is why it's going to be an important book. And I can see that with an author, too. And so just being able to look into the future and see what's going to take off and understand why it's working and how it's working, I think that's really important.
Wow. Which takes a lot of reading, I guess, as well. So, you know, you've got to love reading.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you don't love reading, don't get in this business at all.
I would agree with that. And luckily I love reading. I mean, this is the problem with Kindle, of course. You can just download hundreds of books and you just...
Yes, exactly.
It's amazing. But okay, so just tell us a bit about the books and the courses that you have available for writers.
Okay. Probably the easy way to do it is just say go to www.mystorydoctor.com. Okay. And I have my books there and I have my writing courses. Probably my most popular course is called The Story Puzzle, where I teach you how to think about and outline a best-selling novel. And so if you've got a novel idea, then we just talk about how do you turn this into a bestseller? What's the way to do that? And then I have courses on writing, the writing mastery courses, where you actually write the book. And then I have rewriting to greatness, where you learn to go through and do rewrites and say, okay, this is how you make a good book better. And so there's a number of different types of courses there. And then I also have seminars, so that if you want to, for example, learn a little bit about how to write for young adults or something like that, they have little one-hour seminars that you can take, and you can do that. And then I also have courses that I teach live. So, for example, next year I'm going to do a big two-week course that is an in-depth course on writing, plotting, and characterization. I guess it's plotting and characterization is what I want to focus on. I'm world building too. But it's going to be the longest, biggest course I've ever taught. And so I'm kind of getting excited about doing something like that. But I do a lot of different courses, and you can take them at your own leisure, and you don't have traveling expenses if you do them online, which works great if you're in London. I mean, I get a lot of people who fly over from Europe and stuff like that, and I'm going, you know, you can take 5 courses online for the price of one, and when you do all that traveling. So, you know, there's great, but it's a great thing to do. And of course, when I do the online courses, you turn in assignments, I go through and critique them, give them back to you, and it's me personally who does it. It's not some secret assistant. And the other thing that we do is we have online chats, like what we're doing right now, that we do half a dozen times a week, and so that you can ask questions and get feedback live and those types of things.
Wow, that sounds awesome. So that's at My Story Doctor.
MyStoryDoctor.com, yep. Always wanted to be a doctor when I was young, and now I'm a story doctor.
And did you want to mention the coupon?
Oh, yes. For this month is NaNoWriMo, okay, National Novel Writing Month. And if you use the coupon NaNoWriMo, 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 I'm just going to keep that up for the next month, so that it'll probably expire about the 1st of January, but you'll go ahead and get a 20% discount on any course that you take. And it's whether it's live, whether it's a seminar, whatever you want to do.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. It's very generous of you. So where can people find your other books? Because you've got another website, haven't you, as well, for your fiction?
Yes, for my fiction, go to www.davidfarland.com. And that's the name that I write under. So all of my books are on there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Dave. That was great.
Well, thank you very much, and you have a wonderful day there.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.